Hungarian air in Germany after the Second World War. In a sense, Adorno is trying literally to face the music. There's something embarrassingly unresolved in Wagner's public image and a sinister element in his works that'll never vanish. It's foolish to equate him with Nazism, but it's equally foolish to ignore the mechanisms of history that have implicated him more than any other major figure of the 19th century in events of unspeakable horror. It's in order to overcome this almost insurmountable barrier, Adorno is suggesting, that we must confront Wagner in a rational way that distances us from his repellent social character, while at the same time bringing us closer to his music and what we still feel is important about it.
John Dethridge on Wagner and Adorno, and that was the last of this week's essay series, Wagner's Philosophers. The series was produced by Clive Portbury and first broadcast in May this year. BBC Radio 3, it's 11 o'clock, and now World on 3 with Mary-Ann Kennedy.
It is music and dancing that makes me at peace with the world. The words of Nelson Mandela, now lying in state ahead of a private family burial this Sunday, after a week of commemoration, of celebration, of ceremony and controversy, as the world remembers a man who embodied a nation and a people's struggle, who American President Barack Obama described as the 20th century's last great freedom fighter. You're listening to World on Three with me, Mary-Ann Kennedy, and in the second hour of tonight's show, I'll be introducing a session from Malian kora player Balake Sissoko. But first, we're going to take time to pay tribute to the great man. It was obvious from simply watching Nelson Mandela, whether on the world's great stages or in amongst ordinary people, that he most certainly loved music, and he was wise to its power in the struggle against apartheid. In South Africa, music was at the heart of the matter. For the next hour, Andy Kershaw traces a path through the music of that time, starting in the 1950s through 60s and 70s exile and defiance, the rising tide of 80s voices demanding freedom for Mandela, to the songs that celebrated the end of apartheid and the birth of the Rainbow Nation. Andy Kershaw introduces the Mandela Years.
I, Nelson Rodrigues Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa and do solemnly and sincerely promise at all times to promote that which will advance and to oppose all that may harm the Republic, and true to the dictates of my conscience, due to justice to all, and to devote myself to the well-being of the Republic and all its people. So help me God. Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. The sun shall never set on so glorious a human achievement. Let freedom reign. God bless Africa. I thank you.
On the 10th of May 1994, 4 years after his release from almost 3 decades in jail, Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as the first president of South Africa elected by a multiracial vote. It had been, as the title of his autobiography would note, a long walk to freedom, not just for Mandela himself, but for a nation. Those years of incarceration and Mandela's dignified resistance to the inhumanity of apartheid conferred upon him a moral authority unequalled by any other figure in recent history. The kindly, avuncular man who strode out of Victor Verster prison on the 2nd of February 1990 was not the bogeyman who, only 3 years before, UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had characterised as a terrorist. He was humility and forgiveness personified, and the conscience of the world. Music and politics in Africa are more tightly entwined than on any other continent, yet Mandela gave us only the most meagre hints to his musical tastes. One group he did reveal he enjoyed is the Soweto String Quartet, and, according to an assistant in Mandela's office, speaking of their music, she said, "The old man loves it." Mandela's age was some guide to his musical predilections. Born in 1918, he grew up in the era of swing and the big bands. Those American styles made their impact in faraway South Africa and helped local black pop music there find its own identity. The jazz and jive of the Township Shebeens was a local take on swing, stripped down to its basics by the necessities of poverty. Among the most popular of those groups, particularly in the 1950s, was another of whom Mandela spoke fondly, the Manhattan Brothers. In April 2001, I was privileged to compare a huge event in Trafalgar Square called South African Freedom Day. REM was the biggest name among a number of major rock bands, but topping the bill, and a bigger attraction than any rock star, was Mandela himself. But what was particularly delightful that afternoon was that the Manhattan Brothers, still going strong, performed at Mandela's personal request. For a brief period back in the 1950s, the Manhattan Brothers had a young female vocalist. Her name was Miriam Makeba.
La kuchona ilanga zakubuya inkomo kauleza kalo ufike zihleli ngamaxhala nabantwana nentsatshana yintoni na ungabuyi lakutshona ilanga yakuvela inyanga phesheya kolwandle zakubuya neentaka abantwana abalali bacinga ngawe sendiphume ezibhedlela nasedolongweni yini nananase ungabuyi usekhaya
Miriam Makeba with the Manhattan Brothers. She left the group in 1959 and left South Africa altogether, although that wasn't her intention at the time. She'd travelled to the United States to attend the premiere of the groundbreaking anti-apartheid film Come Back Africa, in which she'd appeared, and when she tried to get back, she found her passport had been cancelled. As it turned out, Miriam Makeba was one of many prominent South African musicians who ended up spending most of their lives away in exile. Between then and her death in 2008, Miriam Makeba carried the passports of 9 different countries. She became a big star in the United States, and right from the start, she was singing songs which talked about the injustices of apartheid. And she made sure the message wasn't lost on her audiences.
I began to see things much clearer, and I could not afford the luxury of just being a singer who sings about happy things and love and so on and so forth. I felt that I have to sing about the true things that happened to us as a people.
Kauleza. Kauleza is a South African song. It comes from the townships, reservations, locations near Johannesburg. The children shout from the streets as they see police cars coming to raid their homes for one thing or another. They say, Kauleza, Mama, which simply means, hurry up, Mama, and hide. Please don't let them catch you. Kauleza mama, kauleza mama, kauleza mama. Nanga mapolisa zongenelela mama, kauleza mama. Nanga mapolisa zongenelela mama, kauleza. Jonga, jonga, jonga yo kauleza mama, kauleza mama, kauleza.
Mandela, a fan of Makeba's, always understood how important music was in the struggle for freedom. When Miriam Makeba died in 2008, he paid his own tribute, saying, "She made us proud, and she used her worldwide fame to focus attention on the abomination of apartheid. Her haunting melodies gave voice to the pain of exile and dislocation, which she felt for 31 long years. At the same time, her music inspired a powerful sense of hope in all of us." So, in this programme, we're looking back on the music of the Mandela years, from the early days of apartheid in the 1950s through to the end of his presidency in 1999, and especially the music that influenced or reflected the political struggle. And you'll be hearing some of the interviews I did for a Radio 1 documentary when I went down to South Africa back in 1995 to take a look at the Rainbow Nation 1 year on. And I'll also look forward to telling you about the time I met Nelson Mandela accidentally. In 1961, Mandela became the leader of the ANC's armed wing, Umkhonto Esizwe, the Spear of the Nation, and began a campaign of sabotage. He was arrested in 1962, and 2 years later, he was sentenced to life imprisonment. For the next 26 years, Mandela behind bars became the most powerful of symbols of a struggle which intensified within South Africa and around the world.
We are not going to accept one man, one vote. It means our destruction. We will not accept it now, not tomorrow, never ever.
Since June the 16th, when South African troops and police opened fire on a peaceful school children's demonstration, the white government has presided over the largest massacre of its black population since South Africa came into existence. The schoolboy who led that day's protest was 19-year-old Tsietsi Mashinini.
I saw a child of 8, and this kid innocently raised his fist in a black power sign and said, "Power to this passing hippo." The hippo stopped there on the spot and they opened fire on this 8-year kid. When I went to the mortuary on the weekend, I saw this kid at the mortuary riddled with bullets beyond recognition.
On Friday, my mother and our attorney saw my father at Paul's Moore Prison to obtain his answer to Boeta's offer of conditional release. My father says, "I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated."
Eugene Skeef is a London-based South African musician and composer, a former activist, a friend of Steve Biko, and a former exile. Eugene, we were just listening there to one of the songs of Umkhonto Esizwe, the Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the ANC, but surely back in the days of apartheid, you couldn't get together and sing that kind of stuff, could you?
Well, the courageous amongst us would sing some of those songs, but a lot of the kind of songs that were more popular long before Mandela's release, campaigning for his release, were the kind of Christian-based, you know, almost churchified type of songs.
Gospel.
You know, gospel-type songs. Yeah. And one of them is a song that is very, like a plaintive cry. It was called Senzenina, you know, Senzenina, Senzenina, and so forth, which literally means, what have we done? Oh, what have we done? You know, almost like a plea to the Afrikaner oppressor, you know, to have mercy, if you like, you know.
So a lot of the songs that were important in the struggle, you're saying, weren't overtly political or militant or campaigning in their message. In many senses, they had to be covert, and they had to be almost coded in what they said.
Yep. Like a song that was sung by women, a chant that says, "Watintumfazi, watintimbogoto." You know, if you touch a woman, you have dislodged a rock. And that was a metaphor for, you know, watch out if you mess with the women, you know, you'll have to deal with the rock that can strike you. But it wasn't, you know, so you're right, it was covert, you know, nothing was out there in the open. But that changed much later when younger people, especially after the Soweto uprising of 1976, so the latter half of the 70s and the 80s certainly changed, where young people took, if you like, the struggle into their own hands and asked the older, you know, their parents' generation to step back. And they took the lead, went onto the streets and invented the toi toi, you know, which was a more affirmative, you know, powerful sort of chant.
Yeah. It became more militant. Tell us what the toi toi was.
It's a chant, a rhythmic chant that actually borrows from Zulu and other African traditions, South African traditions, that is very, very powerful. And you need to be young, you know, to have the energy to keep it going. It's like, Nelson Mandela, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And then you lift your knees to the sky, if you like. And there was a little chant, a little playful chant inside the toi toi that where the young, the leader of the toi toi, once he felt the energy was going down, would say 45 degrees, which meant that you had to lift your, you know, your knees, at, you know,
to like 45 degrees.
Otherwise, you were too old for it. Yeah.
So Eugene, post Soweto and the massacre in 76, the songs became more militant. What kind of things were you singing at those rallies and gatherings back then?
I remember songs like Siaya, Siaya, that translates as we are going, you know, we're moving forward to freedom. And I remember a chant, which refers to a black dog being pulled with chains, with obvious reference to our people. In an interesting way, Shosholoza, the song that is known all over the world, which is a song actually in praise of the train that brings in workers from the Southern African hinterland to work in the mines and such like, that became co-opted, if you like, because of its upbeat rhythm and stuff, and became almost like a second national anthem. So the you know, Shosholoza, the words would change, and phrases would be put in that were relevant to the struggle. But the, you know, the vibe, the beat, was the thing that pulled us all together. So that, songs like that, I remember that becoming one of the more popular songs in our rallies, yeah.
And was that proscribed? Was it forbidden to sing those things publicly?
Well, you know, when the police, you know, the Buddha and stuff came, you would just switch to the innocuous verses. You know, you'd sing as if you were just singing the praise
about the train.
About the train, yeah.
Right,
you know,
I get
that
you.
Kind of thing.
As international momentum against apartheid spread around the world, for the next 2.5 decades, there were many memorable and one or two not so memorable songs about Mandela, both from South African musicians, many of whom were struggling against censorship, and musicians in the wider world. Here are a few of them.
Free Nelson Mandela.
Perhaps best known of all from the UK, Free Nelson Mandela by the Special AKA. This record was banned in her native South Africa, Brenda Fassie's Black President.
Many painful years of hard labour.
Youssou N'Dour from Senegal and his song, Nelson Mandela. And again from South Africa, Sipho Hotsticks Mabuse with Free Mandela. From what was then Zaire, Papa Wemba with Esclave, Slave. Liberté. From Jamaica, young roots reggae singer Yami Bolo, who gave the world the line, "I heard that Mandela was a jolly good fella." Apartheid was sure to crumble after that. In 1985, Mandela smuggled a letter out of prison addressed to Hugh Masekela. Like Miriam Makeba, Masekela had spent decades in exile, and in the 1980s he was in Botswana on a musical education project.
I got a letter from Mandela, my birthday card on my birthday in 84, and in it he knew everything I was doing. He knew the children in my house, he knew my wife, Jabu, he knew what I was doing with the music school. Yeah. And I felt like I was in jail, you know, and when he said, carry on with the work and blah, 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 and thank your father for going to see my wife. And the song just came, you know, Bring Back. I went and sat at the piano, and the song just came. So I can't say these are compositions. I think they're just like transmissions from the folks, you know. To show you that ancestors can get visas to, you know.
We'll be right back.
This is an astonishing scene. I'm on the dance floor of a club called the Shebeen in Johannesburg. It's one of the few places where blacks, whites, young and old mix freely. And they're all still giddy on the novelty of getting together. There's an exhilarating sense of release in this place. As soon as One Love came on, this black girl dancing next to me grabbed my hand and held it up high. I'm looking up now, and all I can see is a forest of black and white hands and arms clenched together. I feel so privileged to be witnessing this, and you feel this could only be happening at this specific moment in South Africa's history. If you played this record again in 2 years' time, it just wouldn't have the same meaning. This is just fantastic. Well, that was me in a rare appearance on the dance floor during the honeymoon period for the Rainbow Nation, just 1 year on from Mandela's 1994 election. Although pretty much swept along by the euphoria of it all, the sense of release and relief, there was, nevertheless, in the background then, an unspoken dark worry that it could all fall apart and rapidly descend into bloodshed. Remember the efforts of Eugene Terreblanche, for example, and his AWB thugs. It was Mandela's extraordinary achievement that South Africa did hold together, albeit with many problems and inequalities still unresolved. And it's probably true to say that no other world leader could have pulled this off. Only Mandela had the respect and support of his people and the moral authority to lead them through it. During my trip to South Africa in 1995, I came to know and became friends with a guy who played quite a role in that transition. In fact, he introduced Mandela's first speech as president, like this.
Let me dedicate my poetic praise to the symbol of resistance. Let me dedicate my poetic praise to the symbol of hope and inspiration. Let me dedicate my poetic praise to the fountain of wisdom and inspiration. I talk of Nelson Rolihlahla Madiba. I talk of Nelson Madiba, Sompitso Nqolomsila. Velabem Pensele Yem Yem. Alala Mandela, uinsimbi gai Kobi. Namusa, usungumongameli. Namusa, usungumongameli. Namusa, usungumongameli. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to take this historic honor and introduce to you the new South African president of the Republic of South Africa, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela.
South African poet and musician Mzwaki Mbuli. He told me back in 1995 how his personal relationship with Mandela began.
I didn't know that the president knew that I existed. I mean, in 1989, I received a letter from prison, Portsmouth Prison, the prison number, saying I should know that I'm loved, respected far beyond the borders of this hometown. That was a big surprise for me. And then when Nelson Mandela himself now came out of prison, surely everybody said Mzwaki is the one person appropriate to be there. And you know, in his huge big rallies at FN big stadiums, I mean, that's where I was called come and recite for the president. It's quite an honor, you know, just not every Tom, Dick and Harry could be asked to come and introduce the first country's black president at inauguration. For me, I
did
mixed
that,
feelings,
yeah.
You know, and it worked, but mixed feelings, you know, anger, compassion, you know, excitement. You don't know exactly how to describe that moment and the feeling, but I feel very much important, such that that letter came to me as a remedy. It was therapeutic, because in 1989 I was like a person sentenced to death. I survived hand grenades from both houses of my home, the three assassination attempts, they shot at me. They did so many things in 1989.
Did they hit you?
Yes, I did.
Well, let's have a look. Bloody hell. Huge, bulbous wound on the... Mzwaki's collarbone, just on the flesh at the top. That was close.
I don't know exactly how to describe. That letter stopped me because I was about to take a decision to leave the country quietly. But when I received such a letter, then I realized, no. Yeah, I think I am somebody in this country. I'm not a number. If a person of Mandela's stature could write a letter to me, who am I amongst... I remain in South Africa. I think my impact would be bigger here than if I were to skip the country, and I remained. And fortunately, miraculously, I survived until now. I'm actually a great survivor. I mean, I'm a great...
Clearly.
I'm a great survivor.
Did you know who it was that shot at you? Did you get a good look at
them? Oh, yes, there were white occupants all the time. Those who stripped me naked, blindfolded me, placed me with leg irons were always white cops, white policemen.
So you were arrested many times?
Seven times, eight different times.
Have you ever seen, on the streets of Johannesburg or wherever, since these incidents of torture and imprisonment, any of your tormentors since?
Oh, yes, 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 they are there.
And what did you say to them, or what did they say to you?
No, well,
you
I passed them. I have no reason to wave or greet them. And I think me, I'm not like the people who are singing about reconciliation unnecessarily. Even at inauguration, you notice well that footage, if you still have that. The president stood up and shook my hand after my poetry, and the deputy Thabo Mbeki did the same, but I didn't bother to shake Mr. de Klerk. I didn't bother that. Reconciliation is just what I read about and watch on television and see. South Africa's entered phase one. No easy road to freedom. No easy road to freedom. Now is the time to make this road easy. Now is the time to make this road easy. Easy for the sake of children. Children the future. Children the kingdom. Children the victims of this crazy world. Children, you and me are the citizens of the planet Earth. Children, you are the citizens of the future. Children, you are the children of the future. The future. The future.
Join us at the Many Cultures One Nation concert. On stage right now, Johnny Clegg and Savuka, and we're looking east as he is joined by Indian dancers, Johnny Clegg, the white Zulu, loved and acclaimed the world over.
Asi bona kumandela tina la pe kona la pe.
Johnny Clegg, the white Zulu, was in fact born in Bacup, Lancashire, just up the road from where I was born. His parents took him to live in South Africa when he was 7 years old. And as a musician and singer, he trailblazed courageously a multiculturalism which, in apartheid South Africa, bordered on the almost suicidal. In 95, he spoke to me of some of the realities of the new Rainbow Nation.
1990 to 1993 was a very, very stark period for all South Africans. We had no sense of the future. We had no sense of what was going to happen. The elections hadn't happened. People had been in business for 20 years, suddenly were ripping each other off. And there was this kind of thing, I've got to live for today, I don't know what tomorrow's bringing. People had been married for a long time, started having affairs. It was this kind of idea that everything was falling apart and one had to basically sit and wait for this thing to play itself out. And I think some of the things that we were doing early on in Juluka, my very first band, have become very relevant. These things are to do with simply sharing cultural experiences. I was never part of the political protest music movement. Yeah, I wasn't a folk singer.
But you did drive a coach and horses through the cultural segregation laws.
Sure.
Didn't you? That must have been very difficult.
But that's different, you see. I wasn't aware that I was making a political statement. I was simply following my heart. I was simply in love with these people and their culture.
But the composition of the band and the musical fusion itself was a political statement and a very dangerous one at the time.
But it was done in such a way that they couldn't really pin it down. They couldn't actually say, these guys are actually Marxist subversives.
Oh. Ladysmith Black Mambazo, of course, singing at Nelson Mandela's inauguration in 1994. Ladysmith were the most famous musicians who didn't leave South Africa during the years of Mandela's imprisonment. I went to see the leader, Joseph Shabalala, at his home in Claremont Township near Durban. Had his audience changed in South Africa, I wondered, since his collaboration with Paul Simon and the international stardom which followed?
It changed. It changed because even the white people, they have chance now to come and listen our music. Although they're still scared to come when we stage a show in the location. Since 1987, after Paul Simon, when we come back, we discover that the demand from both audience now, black and white.
Don't you find it amazing, Joseph, that people in Durban, white people in Durban, had never heard of you, and you lived in the same city, and it took a diminutive musician from New York to come all this way to point out to people in this very town that you were living amongst them, that Ladysmith were here. Do you think this place is mad?
This is amazing. Even myself, the day when I heard that somebody want Black Mambazo in America, that was surprising me, because here in South Africa, it's only black people who know Black Mambazo. Because I was complaining about Eurocentric teaching, and I discovered that all the township people, they don't understand about their culture. Now it's wonderful. Sometimes even here, the teachers will come with the children.
That was Ladysmith Black Mambazo and the song Freedom Has Arrived, recorded in 1993 and composed to celebrate the end of apartheid. When I was down in South Africa on that trip in 1995 for Radio 1, I actually became friends with one of Mandela's bodyguards. His nom de guerre, if you like, was Tyson, for a very good reason. He resembled the former heavyweight champion of the world. And on one of our excursions around Johannesburg, we were walking past the police station in John Foster Square, once the most notorious location for political killings under the old regime. Dissidents, you might remember, used to accidentally tumble from the 10th floor with bewildering regularity. Inside the building, post-apartheid, you found a very different kind of police officer, like Tyson. He's a former ANC activist in exile, and in 1995, a member of the Presidential Guard, and sometimes the bodyguard at Mandela's house. Tyson, it's great to meet you. I've just noticed that you've just pushed your pistol under the pillow. I'm pleased about that. What's Mr. Mandela like? Do you have much contact with him?
Very much contact. And I should say he's a kind of a down-to-earth person, like people see him, and he's just like that on normal terms in everyday life.
So do you have much conversation with him when you're walking around his garden?
Was often, because he's someone who is so friendly to people, even to kids, especially to kids, and he definitely cares about them.
When you're talking to him, do you feel like you're talking to the president, or do you feel like you're just talking to a,
you know, another guy from your neighborhood?
Of course, you know, when I talk to him, like, I respect him as a president, and like everybody does, and as a person I'm always working with day to day, it's like, for me, it's like, you know, an ordinary person to me, you know. And it's so easy to even contact him, and you know, with certain, with even problems to discuss with him. He's someone who is willing to listen and discuss some things like concerns an individual.
Well, as well as being a member of Mr. Mandela's presidential guard, I know that you also have another burgeoning career as a ragga DJ. So before we leave the police headquarters here in Joburg, live and direct inside John Foster Square Police Station and in full effect, Tyson of Mandela's Presidential Guard in a DJ clash with the son of the Deputy Defence Minister, Andrew Casserils. Hit it, boys.
Yeah. This is the policeman called Tyson, live on the microphone stand, along with the Admiral, way down in John Foster Square in South Africa. God of mercy. Hey. This is Tyson on the mic. He tell you a story about South Africa. We come a long, long way. A long, long way. And tell you what I call. We call in the Zambia. We call from Zimbabwe. We call from Angola. We come from Tanzania. We come from Belgium. We come from Russia. Anyway.
And this is also Andrew Casserils with his group, the MK Platoon, and a track called Apartheid Dead, We Stop Use Lead. And it's from an album they made in 1994 to mark the end of the struggle.
What a man, that I know how him strong African. Vote ANC and Pagan, Mr. Nelson. Say everybody get a vote, no bother waste. Oh, no one, no call the lake, say we want freedom.
Andrew Casserils, like many of the children of the ANC leadership, grew up in exile in London. His father, Ronnie, when he wasn't organising guerrilla fighters, including young Andrew, just over the border in Angola, was running military intelligence for the Spear of the Nation during the apartheid years from a flat in Golders Green. Similarly, Oliver Tambo and his family lived for many years just down the road in the North London neighbourhood of Muswell Hill. Until 1994, many of the children of these leaders in exile had never set foot in South Africa, including Dali Tambo, son of Oliver. In Johannesburg in 1995, where he was then hosting a TV chat show, I asked him what it was like when he first arrived in South Africa with his dad.
It was very joyful. We passed through Angola and Zimbabwe and Nigeria, Ghana, Uganda, and a lot of African countries. And as we passed the border from Botswana, it just became green and the roads became straight. And I said to my father, now I understand why we had to fight so long and so hard. You know.
Had you not seen the place before?
No, the further south I'd been is Zimbabwe. But, you know, more emotional was the fact that we were met at the airport. The whole airport came to a stop. All the African workers downed tools and came to meet the plane. And then that was followed by Mandela and the ANC leadership who had come in ahead of my father. Then we came out of the airport and there were like 10,000 people out there. So it was very beautiful and, you know, very emotional for everybody. You know.
How quickly did you feel at home here?
Not that quickly. I mean, we first settled in the townships and that was quite a cultural shock for me after living in places like Crouch End and Highgate and things. But it was a pleasant cultural shock because, you know, you were steeped in your own people. And it took a while to settle, but I was fortunate because he had had the stroke. I was with him all the time. And so I would come to know different parts of the country, you know, would go for 1 day or 2 days to address a meeting or something. But it allowed me to come to grips with the country. And this country still is heaven and hell. I mean, it's still heaven for people like me who can get out of the townships and for white South Africans, and it's still hell for black South Africans, a lesser kind of hell now because, of course, it's an economic hell only. But still, that's hell. But we've started, and so that feeling alone that you've begun the begin is a nice feeling.
For people like you now, is this the land of opportunity?
Sure. Sure, because whether you've been here or in exile, if you escaped the net and were able to get a good education, you know, with the coming of democracy, it allows creative people to get away from politics. That circumstance, plus, you know, having an education, arms you quite well, you know.
Well, you found your niche now as a chat show host on South African Broadcasting Corporation Television. So what, the first show you did then, how did it go?
It went very well because Mandela was the main guest, you know, and he danced and, you know, cracked a whole lot of jokes himself and talked about his sex life and all of this kind of stuff. And so it was groundbreaking in that way. And I remember afterwards a couple of old ladies coming up to me in front of one of the head of Mnet. And saying, you know, Mr. Tambo, we always feared Mr. Mandela, but we've just agreed, haven't we, Gladys, that we're going to vote for him, you know. It humanized people who had been demonized and allowed normal white people to say, well, actually, he's not bad. I mean, I'd vote for him, you know, better than the people I've been voting for.
Dolly Tambo there, son of Oliver. He almost hit the nail squarely on the head there in identifying the quality which gives Mandela such universal appeal. I think it can be summed up in just two words, humanity and humility. And I've got a story of my own about an accidental encounter I had with Mandela when he'd been out of prison for little more than 2 months. In April 1990, I went with my friend Biggie Tembo back down to Zimbabwe, where Biggie was the leader of the great Zimbabwean band, the Bundu Boys. And in April 1990, it was the 10th anniversary of Zimbabwean independence, and big celebrations were taking place to mark this. And one day, Biggie said to me, "Ah, comrade, he said, I have got tickets for us to go to the big stadium, the new stadium on the edge of Harare, where we can see the celebrations." So we went along, and our tickets were right at the top of this stadium, a vast, newly built thing by the Chinese, of course, and we were perched right at the top of this enormous ball. And we watched the military displays down on the pitch, the Zimbabwean army drilled in this by and choreographed by the North Koreans. And we knew at some point, obviously, that Mugabe would be making an appearance. This was in the days, let's not forget, before he went bonkers. Still seemed very much as a beacon for the rest of the continent. And we thought, too, that one or two other members of what we then called the frontline states, surrounding apartheid South Africa, as it still was in April 1990, would also be in attendance. Whilst Biggie and I are sitting there at the top of the stadium, I notice a gap in the fence leading onto the running track and then onto the pitch. And being, by instinct, the journalist and a nosy bugger, I thought, I bet I can bluff my way through that gate and get onto the pitch and get close to the action. So with a spiral-bound notepad and a biro in one hand and my camera swinging around my neck, I walked down the staircase between the seats to this gate and nodded at a security man standing there on the gate. He nodded back and I walked through. Within a couple of minutes, I'm the other side of the running track and I'm standing there with just one or two other local journalists, not a huge press corps by any standards. And all of a sudden, I'm aware of a number of dark suits coming out of the player's tunnel. And as we might have expected, there was Mugabe. And when I looked at the bloke standing next to him, my goodness me, it's Julius Nyerere, the first president of an independent Tanzania. Then there's Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, who was until very recently at that time the president of Zambia. And there's Dos Santos from Angola, there's Sam Nujoma from Namibia, and good Lord, there's Dr. Hastings Banda from Malawi in his top hat, and even the old monster Mengistu from Ethiopia was among them. Suddenly I'm surrounded by all the leaders of the frontline states. And then I swung round to my right, and there, unannounced, unadvertised, nobody knew he was going to be there, was Nelson Mandela. And he's standing about 18 inches away from me. And it was just a reflex. There was Mandela. I stuck my hand out without thinking with the words, "Mr. Mandela, really nice to see you." And he took my hand and he squeezed it with the words, "And very nice to see you too." And then I said to him, "Please can I take your photograph?" And he said, "Of course." By this time, you must understand, the crowd had begun to realise who was down there on the pitch. And the swell was building and building. They were going mad. And he's talking to me. And I'm saying to him, "Can I take your picture?" And I'm fiddling around with the lens cap and trying to get the camera focused. And he could see how nervous I was. He could see my hands were shaking. And at one point, he leaned forward and he said to me, most solicitously, he said to me, "Ready?" And I said, "I think so." And then he took a little step back and he adjusted his tie and he let me take his photograph. And I managed to get this done just in time before a bossy lady, who turned out to be from the Ministry of Information, came bustling up and she said to me, "Excuse me, where are you from?" And I pointed right up to the top of the stadium. And I said, "I'm from up there." And she said, "Where is your press accreditation?" I said, "I haven't got any." She said, "I suggest you go back to your seat." But just for that moment, with all that attention on him and that big crowd going wild for him, he found those two and a half minutes just to deal with me. And once I'd been instructed to return to my seat, I had to walk back up to the top of the stadium, up the steps, the aisle between the seating. And as I went back up that staircase to the seat where Biggie was waiting for me, people on both sides of that aisle were climbing over each other to shake my hand, to shake the hand that had shaken the hand of Nelson Mandela. That was a measure of the affection in which he was held. What a top man.
Let there be justice for all. Let there be peace for all. Let there be work, bread, water, and salt for all. Let each know that for each, the body, the mind, and the soul have been freed to fulfill themselves.
La, la, la.
La.
Enter into a covenant that we shall build the society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall without any fear in their hearts, assured of their inalienable right to human dignity, a rainbow nation at peace with itself and the world.
La, 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 la.
The SAC Choir ending that musical tribute to Nelson Mandela. You heard, amongst others, Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and the praise poet Mzwake Mbuli. But do look up the playlist on the Radio 3 website for full details of all the music. And thanks again to Andy Kershaw for guiding us through that hour. The producers were Roger Short and Trevor Dann. You're listening to Marianne Kennedy here on World on 3, and I'll return to Mandela before the end of the show. But first, in the second hour, a session from Malian kora player Balake Sisoko. He's perhaps best known for his collaborative work with musicians as varied as his famous kora counterpart Toumani Diabaté and Italian pianist Ludovico Einaudi. Balaké's last two albums have seen him working with the French cellist Vincent Segal to great acclaim, and he and his quartet have just finished a UK tour with music from his most recent album, produced by Vincent, called At Peace. He and the quartet came into the Broadcasting House studios at the beginning of the tour, straight off the train from Paris, and even with the early start and not much time to relax, they instantly set about creating a very intimate atmosphere as the backdrop to Balaké's chamber music for Cora. He explained a little more about his approach to the music with the help of Fabien Girard translating. But first they played, and the quartet started out with Bajoro. Bajoro performed live in the studio in session here by the Malian Cora player for World on 3, Balaké Sissoko and his quartet. And it comes from his new album, At Peace, a perfect title if ever there was one. And Balaké is just joining me at the studio table here with Fabien Giraud. Balaké, just watching you and the quartet there, the music is so expressive, but there's so little movement. Is that an important part of how the music is made?
Oui, l'idée même, c'est ça, essayer de montrer la musique malienne autrement.
The main idea is to show a new way of performing the Malian music. It's a kind of classical Malian music, so it's smooth and very, very acoustic.
And very intimate. You have worked a lot with musicians from the Western musical world. Is this particular album then taking you back into your own roots and looking at your own music?
Je fais beaucoup de collaborations, donc ça m'a donné plein de choses. Donc j'ai apporté et puis là j'ai donné.
With collaboration with all people all over the world, he gave a lot and he took a lot. And yes, it's a way to go back to his own tradition and to find a new way of playing this type of classical music.
But just like with your previous album with chamber music, you've worked again with the French cellist Vincent Segal. What is special about the two of you working together?
En fait, c'est ça. Vincent, c'est récent. Donc là, j'ai beaucoup travaillé avec des pianistes italiens, des grecs.
With Vincent, it's a brand new work, but he had collaboration with many other people all over the world. And working with Vincent, it was funny because people thought that we had to write music to play music, which was not the case. Vincent, of course, can write and read music. Balaké can't. But music, there's no custom between all the music, so it worked like this with Vincent.
It's a language, a conversation.
Mm. Une sorte de langage entre
tout
vous.
Tout à fait, oui.
Exactly.
You're going to play some more music just now. Vincent, although we've been talking about him, is not here with the quartet this evening. You have Fassari and Moussa Diabaté and Umar Niang as your quartet here tonight. But just tell us a little bit about this next piece, Kalata Diata.
Kalata Diata, c'est-à-dire Kalata Diata, ça fait partie du répertoire de Sundiata, donc dans le 12e, 13e siècle.
It's from a Sundiata repertory, 12th, 13th...
Century.
It was usually played with a voice.
And you are the voice.
Mm. Yes.
Excellent. Well, let's listen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Balake Sisoko in beautiful session with his quartet Fasere Diabate on balafon and Musa Diabate and Umar Nyang on guitars. More in a little while here on World on Three with me, Marianne Kennedy. Now, it's a rather unusual show tonight with Andy Kershaw's tribute in the first hour to Nelson Mandela. Remember, you can listen to that again on the iPlayer, but there is still some time to play a few new releases as well, including this from Brazilian percussion legend Nana Vasconcelos from his new album, Inspired by the Elements. This is Coco Lunar.
Bye.
A rather gorgeous South American combination there with the unique musical imagination of Argentinian singer and actress Juana Molina and Eira from her new album Wed 21. Following on from one of northeastern Brazil's great percussion masters, Nana Vasconcelos. You're listening to World on Three with me, Marianne Kennedy, and more still to come from our session, which came from Kora player Balaké Sissoko and his quartet. But first, let's head for Belgium and that right boxy, brassy mélange of a band, Jaune Toujours. Like Balaké, these guys like nothing better than swapping ideas with musicians from all over, and the same applies with their new album, Roots. The Ethiopian, or more correctly, Eritrean krar is the backdrop to this song from the new album. This is Si J'étais Toi.
Si j'étais toi et t'étais moi, on s'aimerait encore, qu'est-ce que tu crois? On rêverait encore de l'autre bord. Plus vert que ça, il n'y a pas. On n'a plus l'âge, l'avantage, mais du regret. On n'en a pas, du regret. On n'aura pas. Ce bourgeois qui est en moi, je ne l'aime pas, mais il est là. La rebelle qui est en elle me va très bien, ça la rend belle. Elle demande pourquoi, on répond pas, elle ne lâche pas, elle hausse la voix, elle monte les gestes, elle lève le bras. La rebelle qui est en toi, il n'y a rien de tel pour moi. Si j'étais toi et t'étais moi, on s'aimerait encore, qu'est-ce que tu crois? On n'a plus l'âge de l'avantage, mais du regret, on n'en a pas, du regret, on n'en a pas. Thank you.
First up there was Belgium's Jaune Toujours with If I Were You and You Were Me, what they admit to being their first ever recorded love song. And that comes from their new album Roots, very appropriate title for a band who are constantly travelling down new musical roads. And it was followed by Sar Anjam from the new improvisational collaboration from UK-based Kevin Siddiqui and Bijan Chemerani. Their new album is called Imaginarium, out on World Village, and it's being launched tonight in Paris. Well, we heard earlier with Andy Kershaw how important a role music can play in politics, nationhood and identity. And this next band very much sum up the sound of newfound independence in 70s Cap Verde. Funana was a kind of music previously much frowned upon by the colonial authorities. But with a new era of self-determination, Bulimundo took the genre into the contemporary world and gained a huge following that sprang up first from Electric Funana's original hotspot, the Bulimundo Sports Centre. The band's music is re-released on a double CD set on Loose Africa, and this is Domingo Dencho.
Thank you.
Independence from Portugal for Cape Verde and for Angola in the 70s. That was Bongololo by Quito, one of the acts showcased in the latest collection from Sammy Ben Redjeb's Analog Africa, a distillation of three record labels in this collection that produced a huge amount of material over a relatively short space of time in the late 60s and 70s, and essentially captured the soundtrack to Angolan independence. And this new compilation, Angola Soundtrack 2, also features interviews with Luis Montes, the enterprising Portuguese civil servant whose Sunday afternoon festivals, the Cutonocas, were at the heart of this new musical scene. Before that was Bulimundo and their electric funana that gripped the imaginations of the liberated Cape Verdeans in the 70s. This is Marianne Kennedy with World on 3, and I'm going to be playing a few more tracks connected to Nelson Mandela and Andy Kershaw's tribute at the very beginning of tonight's show. But first, let's return to Balaké Sissoko and his quartet playing in session for us here in Broadcasting House just a couple of weeks ago as he shared his vision for a kind of Malian classical chamber music. Thank you. That was just glorious, the Balaké Sissoko Quartet playing for us in session here on World on 3 in the Broadcasting House studios. And Balaké's just joining me over on this side of the studio again. And I think, first of all, you're very brave to be leaving the kora there, because it's not your usual stand that you have the kora sitting on. We've had to take a piano stool to pieces and turn it upside down, so I hope it all stays in one piece and that whoever plays the piano next doesn't fall over either. But that Asabranka is a real what we call in English an earworm. The tune goes into your head and it stays there. You keep wanting to sing it and sing it. Tell me a bit about it.
Bon, en fait, ça là, j'ai découvert ça avec Vincent.
He discovered his song on tour in Brazil. From a well-known man called Luis Gonza. So he wanted to reinterpret this piece with no voice, of course. That's what they did.
But it sits beautifully on the kora and on the balafon, especially. It seems to show very much where the roots, the connections actually are between the two musics. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Good. Going back to the other elements in the album, you were talking earlier about trying to create something that is like a classical music for Malian music. What elements do you think allows you to create that kind of setting for this music?
Oui, ben, en fait, moi, d'abord, là, je suis quelqu'un, là, je me suis fait grandir avec le calme.
He grew in a musician family and he liked to be in calm. He lost his father at 13 years old. His father was a great kora player. So he grew up quite alone. And before giving to other people, he wanted him to be okay. So he needed many calm to grow up. And then he could play music for other people. And thanks to this way of doing, he doesn't play as people think African music is. African music is not only percussion, etc. It can be very acoustic and very smooth.
So. We think of family musicians, the griot. You know, I come from a family of musicians as well. You think of it as being a very community orientated pursuit. Did having to grow up without the guidance of a father musician, did that mean that you followed a different path as a result?
Oui, mais ça, ben, je travaille aussi avec le génération de mon père. Donc, dans l'ensemble instrumental du
monde. It didn't break with tradition. Even if his father died when he was very young, he worked with many traditional players. And he also played in the National Instrumental Ensemble of Mali. There were people from different ethnic, but he noticed that some kind of instrument never played with another kind of instrument. But something, he changed. The way is very different, is that he starts to melt all these kind of instruments.
It's not breaking rules, it's new possibilities.
Mm. Tout à fait.
Excellent. Okay, well, we're going to have one more piece of music from you, not from the album, so just tell us a little bit about Bitile.
Bitile, yeah. Bitile, c'est l'actualité qu'on a aujourd'hui au Mali.
This piece is directly connected to what's happening in Mali today.
Need to see no more. Thank you so much, Balaké. Thank you. wonderful stuff. Thanks a million to Balake Sissoko and the rest of his quartet, Fassari and Moussa Diabaté and Umar Nyang. And also thanks to Fabien Girard for assistance with the translation. So let's finish tonight, Swirled on Three, by going back to the man on everybody's mind at the moment, and music that's been very much part of my personal soundtrack since the great Isle of Skye accordionist Blair Douglas wrote this tune to mark Nelson Mandela's freedom of the city of Glasgow, given him at a time when he was still branded a terrorist in some political quarters. And my hometown's role in leading the world in solidarity with Mandela and the anti-apartheid campaign hit home just this Monday past as I was coming out of the subway station on Buchanan Street, right beside Nelson Mandela Place. Mandela famously danced in the city's George Square when he was finally free to come to the city to accept the honour of the freedom of Glasgow. And well, as I stepped out onto the pavement that morning with everything busy in a kind of soberly Scottish kind of way as usual, I became aware of some music from behind me and assumed that it was a busker up on Buchanan Street going at it, Dylan style on a harmonica. But that wasn't it. The music was coming from down below and getting louder behind me. And eventually I looked round and saw, bouncing up the stairs in solitary splendour, a young black guy in a smart grey business suit dancing out of the station and accompanying himself on the muthi. He bounded onto and over the bollards without missing a beat and continued to dance down Buchanan Street to his own accompaniment. And I thought, they don't do that kind of thing in Glasgow, but actually, they do. They're still dancing for you in Glasgow Madiba. And this is the music that sums it up for me. Blair Douglas from his album Summer in Skye. Nelson Mandela's Welcome to the City of Glasgow.
Na bonga bantu. Usefikile,
We finish where we began World on Three tonight, remembering Nelson Mandela with Hugh Masekelas, Chileshi, and Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, Freedom Has Arrived. Thanks to James Birtwistle in the studio and Roger Short and Felix Carey producing tonight. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online.
Hello and welcome to Through the Night on BBC Radio 3. I'm Katriona Young, and tonight I thought I'd banish the feeling of midwinter for a couple of hours and head to a late summer festival. This one takes place every year in North Slovenia, not far from the border with Hungary. It's the Maribor Festival, which started as a Baroque celebration almost 40 years ago. It now has a much wider brief as an international chamber music festival. We're going to hear performances from two of last year's concerts. The first featured the Hungarian pianist Dénes Várjon, who began with the last of Janáček's major piano works. He wrote it in 1912, so this was a centenary performance. It's the Impressionist cycle he called In the Mists.